I'm Barbara Pettit, Head of Journal Publications at CFA Institute, and I'm now on the phone with Larry Siegel, the Gary P. Brinson Director of Research at the CFA Institute Research Foundation. Larry, welcome.
Well, thank you.
This year marks the 70th anniversary of the Financial Analyst Journal. And to celebrate this anniversary, we really wanted to offer the FAJ readers a retrospective issue on a topic that is current and relevant for investment practitioners. Now, CFA Institute launched a couple of years ago the Future of Finance Initiative, an initiative to shape a trustworthy, forward-thinking financial industry that better serves society. And it happens that one of the six Future of Finance topics is retirement security. So we picked up this topic as one that would resonate with the readers around the world. We invited Larry, who has a wealth of knowledge in this area, to serve as guest editor for the anniversary issue, and I would really like to thank Larry for doing a great job on this issue. Now, Larry, there is so much that has been written, published in the FAJ over the last 70 years on the topic of retirement. Picking up only a handful of articles must have been really a challenge. Could you share with us briefly some of the criteria you used to select these articles?
Sure. The first thing that I did was try to identify the sub-themes and find one article that best represented thinking on that sub-theme. Those are, at least in my opinion, and I know others will disagree with this list, individual investing, behavioral finance, defined benefit pension plans, long-run rates of return and risk premia, time diversification, asset liability management and duration, savings rates, longevity and withdrawal rates, annuities, and taxes. Once I had that list, I read the tables of contents of 70 years of the Financial Analyst Journal, starting with the first issue. And based on that, I read many articles that I thought would be of interest, and I then tried to map the best, three or four of those articles on a given subtopic into a desire to have historical diversification, something from a long time ago, something from, say, the 90s, something from the last decade, and something from the current decade. And when I was done, I tried to take a look at the reputations of the authors, and of course, most importantly, the quality of the writing and the thinking, and came up with a list that is, reasonably representative of the best of the FAJ over that period.
That's really helpful, thanks. Now, your guest editorial explains why, after 70 years of research, we still have a retirement crisis. Could you please perhaps highlight for our listeners what the key challenges are and perhaps use a couple of examples to illustrate how the articles that appear in this issue offer solutions?
The reason that we have a retirement crisis is that it's hard to save money. And it's hard to save a very large amount of money needed for a long retirement. So with the greater longevity that exists in today's world, only a generation or two ago, people expected to live a few years after they retired. Now it's decades. When your employer is saving it, or the government is saving it, or somebody else is saving it, you don't see it. And you don't realize how hard it is, and that effort also can fail, as we're now seeing with the crisis in the defined benefit world. But when the employee or the individual has the responsibility for saving, they do see it and feel it, and many people don't have enough. That's the real reason that there's a retirement crisis. It goes back to longevity. It's just harder to save for 30 years of retirement than it is for 5 or 10.
Yes. And actually, you've been writing quite a lot on this topic about helping people to understand what the problem is and perhaps find solution. And although most of the articles published in the special issue are reprints from the past, there is actually a new article that you wrote with Barton Waring, retired chief investment officer for investment policy and strategy at Barclays Global Investors. And your article with Barton looks at a very important topic of asset decumulation, in particular in retirement. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about this article, because really you are offering a solution here. Now, very often we're told that the spend down rate should be 3 to 4% per annum. Why do you think this approach is wrong?
Well, a single spend down rate assumes that you know what's going to happen in the markets. And the people who have promoted a fixed rate, where it's essentially a fixed percentage of peak capital or the amount of capital that you've accumulated at the point of retirement, then go on to calculate the percentage chance or probability that that withdrawal rate will fail, where fail means run out of money while you're still alive. Well, I don't know what it's like to go looking for a job when you're 93, but I don't think that it's very pleasant or likely to be successful. So the approach that we took was to say that failure is not an option. What do you have to do in order to calculate the amount to withdraw so that you never fail? And of course, it sounds impossible because you have no idea what's going to happen in the world. It's not impossible. What you have to do is adjust the size of the withdrawal for the amount of money that you have left at the time. It doesn't seem like rocket science, but it's not in most people's calculations. So we added that factor in, which is to adjust the withdrawal upward or downward for the amount of money you have at a given time, after taking into account both market returns on your portfolio and the withdrawals that have already taken place, and that way you are never going to run out of money. We modestly call the paper the only spending rule article you'll ever need, but that isn't quite true because there's still the problem that these spending rates are very low, and in order to get higher spending rates, which most people will want to do, they will want to annuitize some portion of the portfolio, and that's a different article.
So really, in terms of the rule that you propose is very much like taking this annuity framework and doing it yourself. Now, why do you think that this is a superior approach to going to an insurance company, for example, and buying either an annuity or a deferred annuity? Because these products are actually available in quite a few countries.
Well, if the insurance industry were a little better hedged and you could forecast that their balance sheet would be sufficient to pay you in 50 or 60 years, then I would more strongly support the insurance solution because it really is a better solution. The self-managed virtual annuity that we propose does not benefit from mortality risk pooling. You don't get the money from the people who die young to help support the people who die at an older age. It's just you're getting your own money back. So one of the most important sources of return in a retirement strategy is simply lost without the insurance company creating such a pool in an annuity. However, Barton and I were both concerned that if you buy, let's say you're 30 years old, you're buying the rights to receive annuity payments when you're that stretch on out to 105 years old, that you need to be able to identify an insurance company that's still going to be there in 75 years. And we don't really know how to do that, so we hedged our recommendation to use annuities. In a different article, Stephen Sexauer, Dan Cassidy, and Michael Peskin, and that article is called Making Retirement Income Last a Lifetime. They did explicitly recommend an annuity as the key to the longevity risk, and that the deferred annuity one that, in the case of their article, starts paying at age 85. If you buy one of those and it's large enough to pay your expenses, most people wouldn't, you know, put a lot of money into an annuity, but let's say that you did, then you only have to invest for 20 years, age 65 to 85, and that's a much shorter time horizon, much easier to get a grip on, and much easier to save for.
And I think one of the interesting elements in the article is very often when people think about the annuity-based spending rule, they think about building a laddered portfolio of some type of sovereign inflation-protected securities, such as TIPS in the United States. I think one interesting element is that you can actually have a portfolio that has got far more risk into it. Now, what is the catch in terms of the risks that you face when applying the approach you suggest?
And you're referring to the Wary and Siegel article, or
to the article that you just published, because to a certain extent, what people will have to do is to reassess every year the payout, and the payout will obviously change because the value of the assets have changed and the discount rate may have changed too. So to a certain extent, people know that there is no risk that the portfolio is depleted until the end. However, and that's the catch that somehow you were alluding to before, they face some type of consumption risk in the sense that they can't guarantee how much they will get.
That's absolutely correct. The risk is that instead of getting 100% pay cut on the day you run out of money, that you get smaller but still troublesome pay cuts at various times in the process when markets are bad. So if you don't invest in a strategy of laddered TIPS, but instead take some market risk, and that's what most people are going to do, and probably should do, then if the market is down, you're going to have a lower payout that from that point forward until the market goes back up again. The market, I'm referring to stocks and any other risky assets that you might have. And it's simply our judgment that the risk of small, but potentially not that small, reductions in consumption is more tolerable than the risk of simply running out of money and having consumption fall off a cliff at the time that you run out.
And really, there is no way to reduce or even eliminate that consumption risk. That's something investors have got to live with if they adopt this approach, correct?
No, you could put the whole portfolio in laddered TIPS, and then there would be no risk to consumption other than the tiny amount of risk for the possibility that the TIPS might not pay off. I can't imagine the United States faulting on its debt, but stranger things have happened. But yes, you can protect consumption that way, but it's not going to be a lot of consumption because current TIPS yields are about zero.
Yeah.
You do get the money back. And so let's say you have $1 million, and if you withdraw $30,000 a year in inflation adjusted or real terms, the money will last 33 1/3 years if you are earning real zero, which is about what you can earn in the market. And so if that's good enough, you're done.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the last interesting element, I think, in the article is the fact that you can actually engineer any shape of payout somehow that you want, and perhaps recognize that earlier on in your retirement you may want to enjoy a little bit more of life, go traveling, have some more expensive consumption goals, and then perhaps adjust later on in life your payout.
Well, that's right. You can engineer any shape payout that you want in the same sense that if you have a fixed amount of money in the bank, you can withdraw it at any in any shape that you want. You know, buy a boat in 2016 and replace your old car in 2018. And in 2017, you don't spend anything other than on food and other basics. And most people's consumption is lumpy like that. Why not plan for it in retirement? The danger with that is that you're going to underestimate the cost of being very old. Feel good, you're going to want to do the same things that you did when you were 60. If you don't feel very good, you're going to have high health care expenses.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's when the behavioral, perhaps, elements come back into the picture.
Sure. It's just hard to know, it's hard to forecast the future. And I go to a lot of conferences at nice places like the Four Seasons, and I see, you know, 87-year-olds playing tennis. It costs a lot of money to do that. Obviously, they've budgeted for it, and a lot of people haven't and aren't there.
I'd like to finish, Larry, with one last question, perhaps, going back to where we started. Why do you think the message has not been heard about the retirement challenges? And more importantly, what can we do collectively to move things forward so that we don't do the 100th anniversary looking back and realizing that the needle hasn't moved that much?
The first thing we can do collectively is save more, recognizing that the rate of return that you earn on your investments is not nearly as important as the size of the investment to begin with. The second thing we need to do collectively is to support efforts to rationalize the system of pension and savings in whatever country we happen to live in. Right now, we're experiencing a pension crisis in my home state of Illinois, and there are parallel crises existing in other places. The reason is essentially that pension plan sponsors budgeted for high rates of return, say 8%, in this century, and didn't earn it. But they made their contributions as though they were going to earn it sooner or later if they held on long enough. But the last 3 years have been great. They haven't made anything like 8% a year in this century. It's been more like 2 or 3. And so they've been falling behind 5 or 6% a year. And if you do that for enough years, you're way, way behind and you can never recover other than by cutting benefits. And it's very painful to propose to people that you've made a promise to, and they say, well, we are sorry, but we spent the money, and you're not going to get the amount we promised. But it's much better to get most of it than to get none of it, and that's why we need to save that part of the system. That's the same thing that I said about the self-managed annuity. You want most, if the best you can do is to get most of it, that's what you want to do. At an individual level, or a defined contribution plan level, we need to collectively support efforts to make that more like a DB plan, and that's by introducing annuities and other decumulation strategies and products into the mix that's offered by employers, and for people who don't have an employer, for the mix that's available to people who do this on their own.
That's very helpful, thank you. And thank you so much, Larry, for taking the time to talk with me and for sharing these valuable insights. I encourage all our listeners who want to know more about the article that Larry wrote, as well as the other articles, to read all of them, which are freely available online on the FHA website. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Barbara.
Copyright 2015 CFA Institute. This program is designed to give accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is distributed with the understanding that CFA Institute is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, investment, or other expert advice. If legal advice or other expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.